Well, good afternoon. I was going to ask if my microphone was working, but unless I've taken on the position of God, I think it is. So we want to thank you all for inviting us here to consider oral argument at your organization. The court travels most of our arguments. We hear in Washington, D.C., in our courthouse, which is sort of kitty corner to the National Archives, if you're familiar with Washington. But we travel five or six times a year to hear arguments around the country because we have national jurisdiction. Usually we do this at law schools. And so we've been trying to have inroads into veterans groups like yours. We're going to be hearing argument at the DAV's national headquarters in August, at an event with the American Legion in October, but you are our maiden voyage for this, so thank you very much for inviting us. So, my name is Judge Allen, and I'll be presiding today. To my right is Judge Meredith, to my left is Judge Lauer, and we're convened today to consider arguments in the matter of Kenneth J. Delano versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Would counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance, and I think you should do it from the microphone if you can, Mr. Eiler.
Yes. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Kenneth Delano, Attorney Kent Eiler. With me at counsel's table today is Attorney John Niles.
Thank you. And could Secretary's counsel enter your appearance too, Ms. Kelly?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chandria Kelly with my second, Amanda Haddock, on behalf of the Secretary.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eiler, as you make your way back to the podium, I understand that you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then we're going to make that happen, and you can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. On January 4th of this year, this court ordered Mr. Delano to provide a memorandum of law addressing three issues. The question of, first, whether this court has discretion or is required to use the federal government mileage reimbursement rate when determining the reasonableness of a reimbursement under the Equal Access to Justice Act, or EJA, for a travel expense. Second, whether that rate is reasonable within the EJA context. And then finally, whether the government's mileage reimbursement rate is consistent with this court's prior case law, as well as that of the Federal Circuit. I would also note just briefly, Your Honor, that Mr. Delano is also prepared, though the court did not ask for the issues to be briefed, the matter of Mr. Delano's printer expenses, as well as the his entitlement to reimbursement of the reasonable expense of his study and analysis in preparation of his case, which if the court does have questions on those issues, we are prepared to address those as well this afternoon. However, I'll first turn to the first matter that the court wished the parties to address in their respective memorandum of law, that of the issue of whether the court has discretion or is required to use the federal government mileage reimbursement rate when considering the reasonableness of travel reimbursement. As we explained, our position, as we submitted in our memorandum of law, is respectfully, this court does not have discretion, because whereas here there exists a prevailing market rate as to what the government will reimburse, the Supreme Court in Richelieu has said courts, including this one, need not and should not go further.
So let me ask you a question on that point, right? Because I'm not a tax lawyer, but I've read a lot of IRS stuff in preparation for this, which is remarkably clear and easy to understand, at least for me. And it's clear that in putting this rate together, there's no question that both fixed, that is overhead, mm-hmm. and variable costs are considered in putting this rate together. So I'm assuming you agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor. We do.
And so if Mr. Delano or anybody, if person X had proved up their variable costs by getting gas receipts, et cetera, and then had asked us to award a portion of the cost that they pay annually for insurance, just separately. Do you agree that we would have, under the law, we couldn't have done that because that's an overhead expense?
You're saying had he... Forget that
there is such a thing as the government mileage rate.
Sure.
And so the person says, hey, I want to be reimbursed. Here are my gas receipts. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use that as shorthand for my variable costs, right? Then he says, oh, and by the way, I have an insurance policy through GEICO, and I pay $1,000 a year, and what I've done is calculate the number of days I drove, and so I want X portion of my $1,000. You'd agree with me that that's an overhead cost, right?
Yes.
And that under the law, we can't award that.
You could. Our position, Your Honor, would be if a applicant demonstrated that they had incurred expense that exceeded the government mileage reimbursement rate. For instance, if...
Just stick with me for a second.
Sure.
I move in baby steps, particularly at the mile-high altitude. So forget that there is a rate.
Yes.
Right? So we're just living in a world where somebody is proving up their costs.
Mm-hmm.
They give me the gas receipts,
mm-hmm.
and we all agree, I think, that even the government would agree, that's a variable cost that is associated. I wouldn't have had to spend that gas because I wouldn't have driven to the law library that day. I can recover that. But he also says, I didn't buy insurance for the trip, but I happen to have insurance on my car, which exists for 365 days, and I'm going to want X percent of that reimbursed to me because... that should be something I get. But as I understand the law, that's an overhead cost that would have been borne regardless of whether there was litigation or not.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes, perhaps. So perhaps you're correct, Your Honor, that at least in the case perhaps of insurance, which is a fixed cost, right, that would be something that the court would not be able to approve, although... obviously, that's not the particular situation here as far as Mr. Delano's application. But...
Well, but this brings me to the next step, right?
Okay.
Which is that functionally, that is what we have. Because we know for certain that the government mileage reimbursement rate, I wish it was a shorthand way to say that, but the rate includes both fixed cost and variable costs. So if we couldn't award the fixed cost if the rate didn't exist, why can we award the equivalent of that by using the rate when that includes something that is otherwise not recoverable?
Well, because essentially, Your Honor, what the Supreme Court said in Richland, even though obviously that was dealing with paralegal rates for paralegals, is that courts are to avoid, if at all possible, having to become an expert in the field of actuarial science. Because assessing and determining actual versus reasonable costs, which is what's provided for by the statute, if it's clear an actuary has actually already done that underlying work, as is the case here, because our position is that it's the prevailing market rate, right? That is the actuaries for the federal government, for the General Services Agency, for the Internal Revenue Service have said, this is what the reasonable cost of mileage, or not, excuse me, just mileage of transportation, what the expense is. And
yes.
So it includes, as Your Honor points to, right, those costs to include depreciation, to include all of the variable and fixed costs that are incorporated into the rate.
Counsel, if I could jump in there. You refer to the IRS business rate as the prevailing market rate. Are you aware that the federal government has a number of other rates that they use to reimburse mileage? For example, the VA uses 41.5 cents per mile, primarily to drive for health care. The IRS has separate rates for charitable purposes and for moving and medical expenses. So why, if there are a number of different rates out there, would the one that you've pointed to be considered the prevailing rate?
Well, I think, Your Honor, simply because it is the market rate that is the most widely used. I mean, and in terms of establishing what the prevailing market rate is, I mean, ostensibly, had Mr. Delano, though, applied for reimbursement at any of the other rates that Your Honor is referring to, I think there would also be an argument that that's the appropriate rate that Mr. Delano should be have been reimbursed at. The Secretary also incorrectly narrows the question by arguing Mr. Delano does not point to a case where a pro se appellant was reimbursed at the government rate for transportation costs under EJIA of a privately owned vehicle. However, Mr. Delano did provide multiple examples to this court in his August 20, 2023 response of federal courts throughout the country that are reimbursing litigants represented by counsel for travel at the rate. Further evidence, Your Honor, we would submit that it is the prevailing market rate.
So, but, you know, the other thing, though, that we do have to consider, because obviously we, as the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, we are solicitous of veterans' interests. In the context of the Equal Access to Justice Act, and just for folks in the crowd, when you get an EJIA award, it simply comes from the United States Treasury directly. It's not taken out of anybody's benefits. So while it looks to maybe the naked eye that we're arguing about how many angels are on the head of a pin because we're talking about how many different cents, when you multiply that out, we'd then be saying that even though person X had insurance on their car for the entire year and would have had that insurance regardless of whether or not they had a claim on which they prevailed against the government, we're going to say because you happen to have a claim that prevailed against the government, we're going to give you some portion of costs that you otherwise would have incurred. And the reason that that's problematic is because then everybody in this audience would then be contributing to the GEICO car insurance that the person was going to have at all. He wouldn't have spent the gas money to go. That was tied to the case. So there really is a big difference there that I don't think can be hidden just by saying it's the prevailing rate. And I want to give you a chance to respond to that.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the I would submit that to the extent that other courts have determined that it's appropriate for litigants, because, of course, that's what the statute is concerned with. The statute doesn't talk about attorney transportation expenses. It talks about expenses. And so if Your Honor used the example earlier of insurance, and what I began to say at the outset, which is I believe that the court on a case-by-case basis might determine that a reimbursement of transportation cost could exceed the government mileage reimbursement rate for privately owned vehicles stems from perhaps a situation where, let's say, as we noted in our response to the memorandum of law, he attempted to keep his costs down, utilized his privately owned vehicle. He did not take a taxi. But you could easily envision a circumstance where perhaps a veteran, if they were to go pick up a copy of their voluminous claims file, might need to rent a van, practically speaking. So that would be a situation where the veteran would need to then prove up a entitlement to a rate in excess of what we would submit is the appropriate rate. And the Supreme Court has said if this court can determine, right, that there exists a prevailing market rate for litigants under EJIA, this court should do so. This court should use that.
Are you talking about Richland then?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, but Justice Alito, and I think it was Justice Alito, in that case, really, I think the better reading of that case is that what he was saying is that this was a rate, not an expense. In other words, the charged rate of the paralegal was better analyzed under the rate concept, as opposed to that it was an expense. You have thoughts about that?
As a fee, is that what you're referring to?
Yes. The attorney charges X, And he basically was saying this fits into the box of that as opposed to an expense.
Right. And I think essentially, Your Honor, what we're saying is that the bridge here is we read Richelin to essentially say it doesn't. And I think that the Supreme Court, as we discussed in a memorandum of law, sort of shot down this distinction about with respect to prevailing market rates, that there would be a distinction. Whereas, you know, that will apply to fees, but not to expenses. Because to the court's second question that they asked the parties to brief about the reasonableness of the rate, right, in this EJIA context, which what is important to remember, Mr. Delano would submit, is that we're talking about an expense that has been determined whether the individual is an attorney, whether it's a non-attorney, whether it is, and the government mileage reimbursement rate doesn't care whether, and we don't know if Mr. Delano drove a hybrid, whether he drove a gas guzzler, a Honda, a Ford, it doesn't matter. It's an estimate of what the out-of-pocket costs are, and the reason that it's used for federal civil employees who travel or for members of the military who travel is because it's the idea that an individual who travels 400 miles, let's say a military member has orders and they have to travel 400 miles, there's not some windfall that individual gets versus the individual who would only have to travel 100 miles on those for a same set of orders.
Mr. Allen?
Yes.
Is there a distinction, though, because typically we're looking at official travel, and I don't think that either party has made the argument that this is akin to. Let's say for a moment that the court disagrees with you that the prevailing rate and whether you call it the business rate, which is what IRS calls it, or whether you call it the government rate for shorthand. Of the other potential rates that are recognized either by the VA, albeit through a different statute, or through the IRS as being options. And Judge Meredith mentioned, in addition to the business rate, the charity rate, and then the medical and moving rate, is there another rate that the appellant could point to that would be an option for a standard mileage rate that would not get us cross-threaded, if you would, with precedent that exists, the Federal Circuit and our own court, essentially addressing the fixed versus variable, whether you want to call it pass-through or overhead. There's a lot of different terms through the memoranda that the parties presented.
Right.
But that's the question. Is there another rate that is available to the court that would not be at odds with our precedent, that would not include any fixed or overhead rates that we should consider?
We would submit, Your Honor, that the government rate, going to the last issue that the court asked the parties to address, is not inconsistent with this court's holding, either in the March case or in the Federal Circuit's decision in Oliveira, in part because the rate at issue, as Your Honor indicated, it's the rate that's appropriate because it's the rate most akin to what Mr. Delano was doing, which is traveling as a litigant under the Equal Access to Justice Act, which corresponds most closely to the rate that the government reimburses under the business rate, if shall we call it, as opposed to the other rates. So it's the most appropriate rate.
But let's say that the court, for the sake of discussion, disagrees with you. And I'd like to focus specifically on the IRS medical and moving rate. Would the appellant agree that that rate, which has been established, does not include, whether you call it overhead or fixed costs, and therefore, there would be no question, based on existing precedent, that would be a reasonable rate for us to consider?
I'd have to confess, Your Honor, I am not familiar with the specifics of that rate and what is or is not included in that rate. But that being said, if this court determines that there is a prevailing market rate, whichever rate that rate happens to be, then even if our position is that the court's utilized the incorrect rate, right, that the business rate, the government mileage, or whatever we call the government mileage reimbursement rate that we discussed in our memo, if that's not the rate that the court determines is the prevailing market rate, but it determines that there is some other more appropriate prevailing market rate, then obviously the court has to determine that that's what's appropriate. But we maintain that it's the travel for a EJIA litigant is most similar to the business rate and the travel that is contemplated under that rate.
Why would it not be more equivalent to the VA rate for medical appointments?
I think, Your Honor, just essentially, well, because other courts have said that EJIA is appropriate in the government mileage reimbursement rate is appropriate in the federal litigation context. And from the standpoint that we want to incentivize litigants, because it is a different, as opposed to, say, the medical rate reimbursement rate, Your Honor, we want to incentivize litigants, pro se litigants, not just before this court, but before courts throughout the country. If there's unjust government action, they should be appropriately incentivized so that essentially they're not out of pocket on these expenses. So that would be our position.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
We've talked about the requirement that expenses cannot be reimbursed under the EJIA if they're overhead-type expenses, but there are other requirements to be reimbursed under the EJIA for an expense, and one of them is that it has to be an expense that would customarily be charged by an attorney to their client. So how do we apply that requirement here? Would a law firm normally pass that expense on if their lawyers had had to drive to the library to do research? Is that something that would normally be passed on, billed to the client?
Your specific last example, Your Honor, of the hypothetical of you're saying if the attorney has to drive to the law library in order to research a case on behalf of a client, it could be. I mean, obviously, if it was specific to that case. But I think that the distinction that we make, Your Honor, in this regard is that, and this is, I think, the Federal Circuit's holding in Oliveira, is that attorneys can only charge an expense when it's specific to a case. The unique nature of a pro se litigant applying for reimbursement of EJIA expenses is only got one case. It's their own. So literally, any expense that they have that's been incurred is going to be under, we would submit, the appropriate interpretation of the statute, reimbursable as a reimbursable expense. Now, it has to still be in conjunction with that case, but or with their case. But I think when you review Mr. Delano's EJIA application, with a few exceptions, and I would note that with respect to the home internet that the court previously denied and dismissed, we would submit that Mr. Delano would acknowledge that because that was, of course, the home Wi-Fi for the entire year, I believe it was, but that it should be on a prorated basis that expense would be reimbursed, even though it was not so submitted in his application. So I think it's just...
What authority is there for that? I mean, the whole authority about the notion that we don't reimburse under EJIA for overhead is that if I'm in a state in which I have to buy auto insurance, then I'm going to have a little gecko with me the entire year. Mm-hmm. I'm bound by law to have him. And the mere fact that I happen to have a claim against the government that year doesn't change that delta one way or the other, right?
Correct.
So we know that the rate that your client is asking us to award includes insurance, some portion of insurance built into the rate. which we couldn't award outside of it. So I just don't understand how we can then award the rate.
Well, but also then, Your Honor, with respect to, but yet the government does do so under the government mileage reimbursement rate, to the extent that, as you indicated, that there are costs that an operator of a motor vehicle, privately owned vehicle, are going to incur, regardless of whether they're traveling on business or not. And that's contemplated for when individuals are reimbursed under the government mileage reimbursement rate. And all we're saying is that that should be true equally for pro se litigants, just as it would be for other parties receiving reimbursement of travel under the Equal Access to Justice Act. We would note that the Secretary points in their memo that the reimbursement of the bus ticket in March suggests this court should only approve Mr. Delano's gas receipts, and had he traveled by bus, that might have been a possibility. However, a gasoline receipt ignores the fact that a gas tank is not emptied before and after each trip. The expense claimed is travel, nothing more, nothing less. This is the end product, transportation. Similarly, in March, what this court did not do was only reimburse Mr. March for the prorated portion of the bus ticket that covered gasoline. The bus company would have billed him and was reimbursed by this court for the insurance that the bus company has for the maintenance of the vehicles. Indeed, Uncle Sam even footed the bill in that case for presumably the profit margin on a $28.
Well, that's not right. I mean, the bus company charges a price.
Yes.
The price might cover its costs. It might be trying to drive out other companies' business and charge below cost. Just like you charge, you know, an hourly rate, a lawyer charges an hourly rate that includes lots of things that you might not be able to charge separately, right? I mean,
yes, but again, that we believe, Your Honor, is the appropriate. This is what the court was saying. We understand Richland to say, which is, again, if an actuary has done the work, this court can simply sit back and say, okay. And I believe, Your Honor, we even referenced, Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Why don't you wrap up?
Okay, yes. I believe, Your Honor, it was in the Sandoval case that essentially once a rate has been established, it's incumbent upon the other party to indicate that that rate is not appropriate. We would simply submit, Your Honor, that transportation is the expense to which Mr. Delano is entitled, I will reserve the remainder of my argument for rebuttal.
And we'll give you your full rebuttal time when you come back. Ms. Kelly, for the Secretary.
May it please the Court. The use of the government reimbursement rate in the EJA context is not reasonable for two reasons. One, it would amount to reimbursement for expenses not incurred solely or exclusively in connection with the case before the court. Secondly, it would allow an EJA applicant to benefit in a manner that is inconsistent with Congress's intent, which was to provide litigants with an incentive to retain counsel. The EJA statute provides that the amount of costs awarded to a provider.
Can I interrupt you for one second?
Yes, sir.
This is going to be an easy question.
Okay.
Could you slow down just a little bit? Because I want to hear what you say, but believe it or not, in this room, the sound echoes off the back, so we're hearing you twice right away.
My apologies. I even have a post-it that says slow down. That is the Detroiter in me, and I apologize for my city. Would you like me to begin from the top, or can you hear? Okay, thank you.
No, I think we followed you. So.
Okay. I can't hear the echo, sorry. The EJA statute provides that the amount of costs awarded to a prevailing party is established by statute, court rule, or order. There is no statute that explicitly requires reimbursement for the cost of travel to take a specific form. However, there is some guidance. While not binding upon this court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit explained in Morrell and Carter that expenses resemble costs and costs represent sums actually expended. Further, this court in March held that expenses customarily charged to the client when the case is tried may be awarded. It concluded that Mr. March's bus fare to the law library, which was a total of $46, was reimbursable. In finding Mr. March was entitled to reimbursement for his bus fare and similar expenses, the court pointed directly to the authority from the Ninth Circuit and in essence noted that the bus fare constituted an expense that was actually incurred. EJIA provides for the reimbursement of litigation.
Could I jump in now with a substantive question?
Which yes, is, sir.
So what do we do with the fact that there are a handful of district court cases out there that award under the EJIA the rate, the business rate? They don't call it the business rate, but that's what they do. What do we do with those cases?
Yeah, no, I believe that the court can consider them, but you're not bound by them. And as I noted, the court does have discretion because there is no specific rule or statute to point to. So in trying to determine what the rate is, I think that the determination should always be made on what's the most reasonable and trying to determine whether or not the particular rate that was put forth by appellant was reasonable or if there's some alternative rate or, as the secretary would provide, that we should do what the case law has already said, which is to look at actual expenses that have been incurred.
And are you familiar with any, not to be critical of our colleagues on the district court that issued those decisions, but there wasn't a lot of reasoning, and my sense is that it might have been because neither party quibbled with the use of the rate. Are you aware of any cases that might have come to your attention that there's an analysis of the use of this rate in the context of EJIA?
Not that I saw, Your Honor.
I didn't either, so
okay.
Just so you know.
It's a very limited situation, and I think that this court actually has an opportunity to try to establish some boundaries because there aren't really any. This is actually the first EJIA matter that I've had for a pro se appellant in the time that I've been before this court, so it's new to me as well. But as the EJIA does provide that the litigation expenses and costs insofar as they were incurred is what's supposed to be reimbursed. So in Olivier, the federal court found that expenses that are not incurred or expended solely or exclusively in connection with the case before the court or the expenses that are found to be unreasonable or unnecessary cannot be awarded by EJIA. And I think that this court found in March, considering Riviera, which held that pro se litigants can't be reimbursed for equipment maintenance and overhead items of a type we find would not be normally billed to a client. So the secretary does concede that appellant is entitled to reimbursement for his filing fee and the cost of gasoline because those are actual expenses that he incurred. However, the cost of depreciation of the original vehicle costs, maintenance, automobile insurance, et cetera, which are contemplated by the government reimbursement rate, are not expenses that he incurs solely or exclusively in relation to the case. Rather, those, again, are akin to overhead costs. The government reimbursement rate was established for those engaged on official business for the government primarily, and the transportation was authorized or approved as more advantageous to the government. EJIA appellants do not meet that criteria. Further, while the government reimbursement rate favors efficiency over precision, it's not limited by the constraints of the EJIA statute. So in trying to make those calculations to include overhead fees and expenses, those rates don't consider EJIA. So while some jurisdictions may use them, that's not how the rate should have been calculated to use. So this court has the opportunity, again, to provide clarity as to the most reasonable method for calculating travel reimbursement. Accordingly, we would ask the court to determine what portion of appellant's travel to the library is reasonable and to use his actual expenses to calculate his EJIA award.
So, Ms. Kelly, I'm glad you acknowledged that the court has the potential, at least, to establish a default rate here. Next, I'm going to ask you to help us, if we were to do that, for the sake of discussion, what would we be looking at? We've got various IRS rates. We have the VA appointment, healthcare appointment rate to look at. You may or may not be familiar with what, and I realize that's under statutory authority that is solely for that purpose. So help us out. If we were to look at establishing something, whether it just applies to this case or is more broadly applicable, what should we be looking at? Because the Secretary's position is, as you said, conceding that the appellant is entitled to the filing fee and to gasoline alone. Clearly, the VA medical appointment rate includes other expenses in there. Do you know what was included?
Your Honor, I'm actually not sure how that rate is calculated. I know that it's roughly about 41 cents right now because I've seen it, but I don't know the calculus that went into trying to determine what that rate is. And I do know that it's not always for personal vehicles and that there can be medical transportation services used. So, I mean, but then again, that's easier to calculate because that's, again, an actual expense. You would have a dollar amount that you pay the same way. If appellant in this case had rented a car, it would have just been the cost of that car rental and the gas that he put in that car. And
for, for the most part, it's used by veterans to go to medical appointments.
Yes,
and
sir.
It's calculated by using application that tells you how many miles it is, and then, as you said, applying the 41-cent rate. So would you agree that there must be something more than just gas that goes into that?
I would agree that that's the case. I just don't know the specific things that are factored into that. But I imagine that gas would be the largest expense for that.
I mean, again, recognizing that that's due to a specific statutory authorization. But again, for purposes of my hypothetical, trying to sit where we are, figuring out if we were to establish a rate for this case, what would it be?
I mean, Your Honor, I believe that if we're talking about actual expenses, if there was a way to break down what those numbers would be, I believe Judge Allen suggested, you know, trying to figure out if this is how much you pay for insurance and what percentage of that would be the miles. If that were documented and presented and determined to be reasonable, then that is something that could be reimbursed. But we don't have that here. We just have the whole numbers, so that there hasn't been any math.
Your colleague, Mr. Eiler, acknowledged that he's not familiar, for example, with the IRS medical and moving rate.
Yes,
are you familiar with the IRS medical and moving rate?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. If that rate did not include, whether we use the term fixed or overhead costs, would that be a reasonable approach if it was based only on variable costs, to include gasoline, oil, brakes, tires? In other words, the principal difference between fixed and variable rate, fixed you're going to pay regardless, right? Variable rate is going to be directly related to the amount of travel done.
Yes,
in this
sure.
case, we have over 2,000 miles that Mr. Delano put on his privately owned vehicle. So can you help the court if, again, for the sake of discussion, the military and moving rate does not include any overhead or fixed rate, is that something that could be helpful?
If it solely includes variables, then I think, yes, that would be a good rate to use.
And you've obviously seen the appellant's, now this was before he was represented, but Mr. Delano's response to the court order back in July of 2023, where he broke out, he was asked to specify the expenses, and he went through, and he had repairs that were made, and he had tire I mean, would you say that's kind of an unwieldy way? I mean, if you're looking at actual expenses, even the gasoline, as appellant's counsel has noted, is difficult because you start with a vehicle that's not on empty, you add to it, it sort of lends itself to trying to come up with, arguably, a rate that you could apply that would be reasonable and that would not include any of the overhead or fixed expenses.
Your Honor, it is unwieldy, but I would like to note that the gasoline mileage that's noted in the application is not an exact number either. That's an estimate he used. It's an EPA and I think Department of Energy. There's a website where you calculate, like, your car and on any given date how far you went, and it did the math. So we still don't actually have the actual gasoline cost, but that's the best number that he could provide with the documentation that he gave. I think This is all very complicated to try to suss out, mostly because EJIA was not enacted with the notion that pro se appellants would be trying to recover fees and expenses. It was supposed to be to incentivize them to obtain counsel. And so I think that's why it's so difficult to try to look at these numbers and try to figure out the easiest way to do it. And that's why we have a case. You know, the last case the courts really heard on this issue was March, and that was in 1994. So it doesn't come up that often. So I appreciate that it's complicated, but the rates that we have generally, including that IRS rate, again, those rates favor efficiency over precision. And so what EJIA says and what March says and Olivia as well, it's not about efficiency, it's about actual expenditure. So I don't know that I can help the court determine a rate other than to give the actual expenses as best one can. I mean, I suppose we could get into estimates and try to figure out how that might be done, but it complicates the issue beyond what I can provide an answer for today, unfortunately.
I can follow up on the point you just made that EJIA was generally intended to be reimbursing lawyers. Under our case law, we've pointed out in the past that when a lawyer submits an itemized expense, we can fairly rely on it because they have an obligation under the model rules to candor towards the tribunal and other ethical obligations. So what is the level of proof we should require for a pro se appellant? What are the guardrails that should be in place, or maybe they are, for knowing what's, what you would need to be sworn under oath, what they're asking for, just a list? Can we rely on just their unsworn assertions? Does VA have a position on that?
Of course it does, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. I think the language that the court uses when a veteran is asking to have the filing fee waived, where they, you know, just swear that they qualify for the waiving of the fee, would be something similar. But I think here, the secretary isn't questioning the expenses that are in the application. We're just questioning whether or not the expenses are reasonable and therefore should be reimbursed under EJIA. So I don't think we raised anything in our pleadings to suggest that these weren't truthful. We just disagree with whether or not they're reasonable for the purposes of reimbursement by this court.
You did raise concerns in your pleadings about whether some of the trips to the library may have related to work done for an appeal to the Federal Circuit that was unsuccessful as opposed to work before the court. And I believe there was another entry that you questioned because it was a trip to the library to investigate the statutes and authorities that VA had relied on, but VA hadn't actually filed their brief yet. So,
yes, Your Honor. And so for the purposes of whether or not that was just for clarification, because we, of course, didn't get an opportunity to respond to all of the different pieces of the supplementals that were filed in the earlier pieces of the litigation. So I'm not suggesting that he did not go to the library on those days, and perhaps there were typographical errors in that calculation for what he did and did not do. So it's not really a question, I think, primarily as to whether he went to the library and did the studying. It's just, I think, the court has to consider whether or not the number of trips and the time that he spent and all of that in trying to calculate what would be considered reasonable.
Thank you.
So, I'm going to ask your friend on the other side this question, and so I didn't get a chance to do it in the opening argument, so I'm going to ask you, which is odd because it would have been better the other way, but that's where we are. So remember, well, you don't necessarily know, but for a long time before I was a judge, I taught constitutional law for a very long time, so put up with me for a second. EJIA is a statute that essentially waives the sovereign immunity of the United States. It allows certain costs to be recovered and fees to be recovered. because the United States is the sovereign, there is a body of law out there that says courts are to interpret waivers of sovereign immunity narrowly. Right? So in other words, if we're not sure, we're going to let the immunity that otherwise is in place stay in place. You with me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Is there any implication here of the doctrine of sovereign immunity? Because it sounds sort of small. We're talking about small dollars. But the fact is that arguably, if you use the rate that the IRS publishes, the business rate, that doesn't say, the government never says, this rate is to be used for EJIA. That doesn't mean it can't be on ground, but it doesn't say you can, which could be deemed a waiver of immunity. And that rate includes elements that weren't directly related to the particular action in which the United States lost. What's the Secretary's position about whether there is an implication here that if we are really unsure, we should default to the narrowest waiver of sovereign immunity that would be consistent with the language of EJIA? I warned you, it was the law professor in me, I'm sorry.
And I graduated 22 years ago, so you were stretching my boundaries today. Of course, indulge, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. Our position would be that you would default to the narrowest interpretation, and that would be to use actual costs, which is what is laid out in the EJIA statute, so the costs that were incurred.
Thank you.
If there's nothing further,
I just have one more question. As you noted in some of your pleadings, at the merit stage, the appellant wasn't successful on both of the issues that he raised. He was successful on the eye condition, but not on the back disability. Does that play in at all to how much should be awarded when we're talking about expenses as opposed to fees?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it would be very onerous to try to parse through exactly what he did on each trip and try to figure out for each version of the research. And, of course, when you're saying that you did research, like even if I was doing it for myself, it would be difficult to say exactly what I did on every day. And it would be inherently, I think, unfair to try to figure out exactly what was done at that point. So because we're talking specifically about the transportation piece and not about the piece for the fee portion, then I think that we would just assume that those don't have to be broken down any further. You just ultimately have to determine whether or not it's reasonable how we calculate the rate, not the specific trips.
Thank you.
Nothing.
Thank you very much. If you want to wrap up, you can. If not, you can sit down.
I had already done my conclusion before you asked me your additional questions, so thank you, Your Honor.
I had recognized that. Thank you very much. As Mr. Eiler walks up here, I can say that counsel, and I can think I speak on behalf of all my colleagues, it is never a sin to leave some time on the clock. So absolutely. Mr. Eiler, feel free. And at some point in your rebuttal, if you could address my sort of sovereign immunity question.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would begin Mr. Delano's rebuttal by noting that during the Secretary's oral argument, Judge Lau asked my friend for help if this court were to adopt a default rate as opposed to what that rate should be. Obviously, Mr. Delano's position remains that the government reimbursement rate is the most appropriate reimbursement rate to utilize. But in the alternative, we would submit that the highest rate that reflects variable costs, that is the rate that's most consistent with the Equal Access to Justice Act's purpose, is the rate that that the statute requires. On the Secretary also noted the two Ninth Circuit cases that they had mentioned in their memorandum of law, that being the Merrill case and the Carter case, for support that this court should only reimburse
Mr. Delano's gasoline. However, to the extent that the Secretary's position during argument today may be slightly different, we would just simply note that wanting to address that nothing in either case, both of which cases I would add, were issued 20 years prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Richland, but nothing in either case, we would contend, supports the Secretary's contention. Both cases talked about the reality that expenses resemble costs. But to do that here, you have to be cognizant of the actual cost, which, as we explained, the government mileage reimbursement rate does a far superior job to that of merely utilizing gas receipts. The question that Your Honor posed to my friend as to what the burden of persuasion of proof should be with respect to applicants under who may not be attorneys, Your Honor, we would submit that I would agree with my friend that the issue is not one of credibility here, but perhaps sophistication. And moreover, when the Secretary raised objections, this Court previously found in the withdrawn August 2023 order that he was entitled to reimbursement of those seven trips. Obviously, we would maintain that the Court should not disturb that favorable finding that it previously made with respect to the trips back and forth to the law library. Judge Allen, to your question as to this tension, supposed tension, right, between the sovereign immunity and the Equal Access to Justice Act, we would submit, probably not surprising, in contrary to the Secretary, that rather than narrowly, that it should be construed broadly. Congress intends waiver. It intends waiver of sovereign immunity. That's the purpose of the statute. So we would submit that we would disagree with the Secretary that the statute should be construed narrowly. Your Honor, if there are no further questions.
I would like to have asked you to clarify. The Secretary's counsel suggested that the appellant had a typo in his list of the seven trips that he took to the library. I believe she was referring to the April 2nd trip because it's listed as purposes researching the authorities listed in the Secretary's brief, but the Secretary's brief wasn't filed until April 26, which was a few weeks later. So I was wondering if you could clarify whether there is some type of mistake in that entry.
Your Honor, as to that specific question, I don't know. I'm not, unfortunately, have the answer to know to be able to resolve that discrepancy. But again, we would submit, and Mr. Delano previously argued, that had the Secretary wanted to raise that objection, it needed to do so earlier in the appeals process rather than at the stage it did so in this litigation. If there are no other questions.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Lauer.
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry, Mr. Ivan.
We would just respectfully submit that the court grant the reasonable expenses that Mr. Delano submitted in his application. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And so I want to thank both counsel, all four of you, for coming out here to Denver, to the Mile High City, for the argument. Before I say the magic words here and our clerk of court says something else, I just want to explain to everybody what we're going to do. You're going to see us stand up. We're not leaving because we're going to answer your questions. But we're going to come down. We have a tradition at our court, which is modeled on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit's tradition, which is the judges come off the bench. And except during a global pandemic, we shake the hands of the council and then we come back up. So we're going to do a little bit of that right now, but then we do encourage any questions that you have. We'll come back up and take them. So with that, the case is submitted.